In the late 1950s, he joined the first Ornette Coleman Quartet, which began a revolution in jazz that was very controversial amongst musicians, listeners, and critics, and he's since played with many of the leading avant-garde and mainstream players of his time. In 1969, he led a now classic session by his Liberation Music Orchestra, which was also controversial because of its radical political references, with a suite of songs from the Spanish Civil War and original compositions like Haydn's Song for Che. Haydn has reorganized the Liberation Music Orchestra, and they recently performed in New York, and they recorded an album that will be released in a few months. He's also playing with Old and New Dreams, a band whose repertory features many Ornette Coleman compositions. The members of the band, Ed Blackwell, Dewey Redman, Don Cherry, and of course Charlie Haydn, are all Coleman alumni. Charlie Haydn will also have an album coming out in about a week or so on ECM Records with Denny Zeitlin. He's going to perform tomorrow night in Philadelphia. It will be at the Ethical Society at 1906 South Rittenhouse Square at 8:30. And for more information, you can call 664-8229. That's 664-8229. Charlie Haydn, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to meet you.
Thanks very much.
I understand that your real musical roots are in country music, and you had a family act, basically, when you were a kid that used to sing country music.
It was a musical group. My parents were both on the Grand Ole Opry back in the early 30s and late 20s, and I have three brothers and two sisters, and as each one of us were born, we were added to the family group. And that's back when radio was a big thing. That's before television. 50,000 watt radio stations back then they reached a lot of territory. And I grew up knowing people like the Carter family, the Delmore brothers, Roy Acuff. I was really very fortunate in that respect to be born in the middle America, which is a very unique place in this country. You have a sense, real sense of Americana there. You see people who play on their front porches, and they live on gravel roads, and they don't have any telephones. And they play the fiddle, not the violin, on their chest, not under their chin. Banjos and guitars that are old and beat up. And we used to go and play on the beds of trucks at fairs, revival meetings. And we had a radio show every day from before I was born, even. And then after I was 2 years old, I started singing with my family. And that was in Shenandoah, Iowa. And then we moved to Springfield, Missouri. My father had a farm. We broadcast from the farmhouse. And before we did our radio show at 4 a.m, we milked the cows and fed the chickens and gathered the eggs and all that stuff, did the chores, and then we did a radio show in the morning, and in the afternoon when I got home from school, we did another one. And I did that until I was 15.
When you were first introduced to jazz, the melodies and harmonies and rhythms of jazz are so different than country music. It wasn't the language that you were brought up with. Did you have to work hard to hear it and then to play it?
The languages are really from the same place, which is from the people and from the feeling of the earth, from honesty, from hurting and joy and sorrow. And so they're both musics that have been born and had evolution in this country. When I first heard jazz, I didn't really know what creative expression meant or improvisation meant. I just knew I loved the way it sounded.
Did you ever encounter any suspicion amongst jazz musicians about country music? Because it was country music being in part a southern white music that had a lot of, quote, coon songs in it. I think a lot of northern people, especially black people, were maybe cautious.
Well, there are racist songs in every aspect of the human condition, American condition, not just in country music. It's a very racist part of the country back then, in those days especially, and I lived in a place where I was brought up around that and grew to abhor that and hate it. And maybe that's my first act of being politicized when I saw the separate movie houses and blacks not being able to go in restaurants and on the buses and all that stuff. I wanted to try and do something about it.
What were you playing before you met Ornette Coleman?
What kind of music?
What kind of music, yeah. What kind of jazz music?
I grew up in the jazz tradition, in bebop and blues and standards and bird tunes and loving every minute of it, learning the language. It was very exciting. And at one point, when I was first beginning to do that in Los Angeles, I started to hear other things to play when it would come time for me to solo, and I wanted sometimes to play on the inspiration that a tune that I received from a certain composition instead of on the chord structure. But when I tried to do this, a lot of musicians wouldn't know where I was and they would become very upset with me. So I had to be careful when I did this because I didn't want to have any hard feelings. And it's really important that everybody is very close and feeling good about each other and themselves when they're playing music. So I had to really pick and choose the places where I did this very carefully, but I was definitely hearing other ways of improvising. I wasn't satisfied so much with playing just on chord structures. And then I met someone who was doing this as a way of life. It was Ornette, and when I first heard him play, it was like a revelation to me, because here was someone who was playing this way as a way of life. He was playing this way years before I had met him, and he invited me to his apartment, his little room in L.A., and this was in 1957. I was 19 years old, and we played all day long, and he had a room full of music strewn all over the floor, the walls, the ceiling. He was constantly writing music, and he told me before we started to play, he said, "Charlie, I've written these pieces now, and here's the chord changes. Now, these are the chord changes that I heard inside myself when I was writing the melody, but these are just a guide for you. I want you to be inspired from them and create your own chord structure from the inspiration or from the feeling of what I've written. And that way, constantly, a new chord structure will be evolving, and we will be constantly modulating, and we'll be listening to each other, and we will make some exciting music." And that's exactly what happened. And it's still happening. His way, and all of the musicians that were brought up with that kind of improvising, it's different from other improvisation in jazz. It's a very unique language, and not very many musicians know about it. It's just a handful of musicians that were playing this music. And it has attached to it, a big part of it is an extreme urgency for spontaneity that's completely different than other improvisation. It's almost a desperate need for a spontaneity, desperation.
You think that desperation gets expressed in the music?
Oh, yeah. It's a positive desperation, not a negative. It's like a wonderful desperation. It's an exploring, discovering all the possibilities that can happen when you become inspired, not only by compositions, but by human beings and by life itself.
Were you surprised at how controversial the music was when you started playing it? You know, a lot of people couldn't handle it at all, musicians, listeners.
I was very involved in learning about the playing. We were all involved because it was a brand new language. We didn't even think of it as being a brand new language. We only thought of it as we're hearing something and we got to play it. And we were constantly learning about what it was we were doing. Things were being born every day out of what we were doing. And there was a lot of controversy around us. When we opened up at the Five Spot in New York, fights used to break out right in the club. People would be putting us down. People would be praising us. The club was packed every night with everybody from different parts of the art world, painters, famous writers, filmmakers, dancers, musicians. I would look out, and standing at the bar would be Paul Chambers, Percy Heath, Charlie Mingus, and they would be looking dead in my eye, you know, and saying, "Okay, what are you going to do?" And I would be playing and have my eyes closed, and one night I opened my eyes and there was Leonard Bernstein with his ear glued to the front of my instrument. And I looked over to Arnett and said, "What is this?" He says, "I'll tell you later." And then we were invited to Leonard Bernstein's table. He invited us to the Philharmonic rehearsals, and he couldn't believe that I was self-taught, and he wanted to try and get me to study music, and he was very helpful in me getting a Guggenheim Fellowship 10 years later in composition. But it was like that every night. It was very exciting. The violence wasn't exciting. I mean, one guy set somebody's car on fire one night, I remember. Somebody came back in the kitchen. We were standing talking with Ornette, and I won't say who it was, and hit Ornette in the face, you know. I mean, it was really a very strong excitation time. New things were happening, not only in music, but in people's minds every night from that music, you know. And
people who are interested in art and music like to think of themselves as being open-minded, I think. Do you have any explanation for why there was so much violence around the season?
It might be sounding more extreme than it actually was. I mean, it wasn't violence every night. There were arguments. A couple of times some fights broke out, you know, people arguing about it. But there were sensitive people there. And the people who formed opinions about us in the beginning, negative opinions, that's not to say that they weren't sensitive people. Anything that's new, anything especially in music that someone has never heard before, they become startled by it, or they become afraid, and they encapsulate themselves, or they isolate themselves, and they draw a curtain around themselves, and they become very narrow in their vision, and they start protecting themselves and their feelings and their views, and they say, "That's no good, I can't take that, and this is good, and that's not good." But eventually, after they let themselves take a breather and they get their thoughts together and they regain their perspective, they see the sensitivity inside them almost forces them to see the good in the music and the importance of the music. And that's the way it was when even critics were putting us down at the beginning of our stay in New York. They came to their senses after a while, after the first big rush and wave of controversy. I mean, we weren't really thinking about that, you know. I mean, that didn't really bother us. People were always asking me why I was the only white musician, and I never thought about that until people asked me about it, you know. But that's the way life is. That's the way human beings are.
Do you miss that controversy now?
Well, I have a lot of other controversy that's been happening. And one is replaced by another as life goes on. There's always controversy when there's new things, always. It never stops. And now people hear the music that we were playing back then, and they can really listen to it, and they're accustomed to it. But there's still a lot of people that don't feel close to the music. It's too much for them to handle.
When you were with Ornette Coleman and playing music that was perceived as very radical, did you do anything to yourself? Did your personality change in a radical way to suit the radical music that you were playing?
Well, I developed some self-destructive tendencies because of the... I think it wasn't just because of the newness of what we were doing and the controversy surrounding it. It was a feeling, I think, that most people who've dedicated their life to an art form that especially doesn't have a mass audience, they develop a feeling of isolation, of aloneness, of that they're in a minority as far as the population of the rest of the world. Maybe they're right and I'm wrong. You know, there's a we-they situation that happens. So that can have a great effect on some people, especially if they're very sensitive like I was at the time and still am, and very impressionable, very vulnerable. And it can knock you out, you know, if you let it, if you can't stand up. And I was very lucky to get back up on my feet and have self-determination and a lot of willpower to become very healthy and very clear in my mind about, and see that it's very important to be healthy. You know, I mean, I think that people who have self-destructive tendencies or character disorders or whatever you want to call it, if they pull through it, they will tell you themselves that they are better people and better artists. I don't like to use that word artist, but they're better at what they do in their art form if they're healthy. That if they are involved in a self-destructive avenue, they are not really able to create to their full potential. I don't believe that is possible.
There is a kind of romantic notion that artists are naturally self-destructive, or that when you're on the verge of madness, you're somehow more creative, or...
Well, some people think that. I don't believe that.
And you never did?
I believe... Well, maybe I did when I was very young. It wasn't that I believed that, because when you're involved in that way of life, you don't really have time to even think about... you don't have any objectivity. You're like a child, you know. There's only one thing you have to think about, and that's existing every day. But, you know, a lot of people have a tendency to treat people like that with a motherly kind of attitude, like, poor baby, here, take this $50 and you'll be okay, instead of saying, hey, why don't you start looking at yourself and growing up and become an adult and mature a little bit?
Let's listen to something that the Ornette Coleman Quartet recorded together. And this, we're going to hear Lonely Woman, one of Coleman's compositions. Do you want to say a little bit about the session before we hear it?
This session, yeah, was done in Los Angeles in 1958, and we had recorded, this was the first record. Ornette had recorded with some other musicians on a previous album on Atlantic called Tomorrow's the Question, and then he made his first album before that was on Contemporary Records, and that was called Something Else. That was the only time he ever played with a pianist, which was Walter Norris. All the time that he was recording these other albums, we were all rehearsing during the day. And then Nesli Erdogan heard us through John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet. He asked Don and Ornette to come to Lenox, Massachusetts to be part of the Lenox School of Jazz. And then when Ornette and Don came back to L.A., Ornette said they want us to do a recording for Atlantic. He said, let's get it together and we'll go in and record the music. And we did, one of the songs on there was Lonely Woman. It's really nice to hear this version of Lonely Woman, which is one of the most beautiful songs ever written as far as I'm concerned, and really inspires the utmost in creativity from whoever plays it. You know, I think that's really a lot of fun to write a piece like that. I don't know if, I guess anybody who's close to composing has that in mind. I know I do. I like to write pieces for different my favorite musicians of mine, and then sit back and watch how they listen, how they play, or how they're inspired by that, because it's a lot of fun. It's very exciting to do that. Like, I've written pieces for Ornette and for Keith Jarrett and for Alice Coltrane and for Archie Shepp and Donna Cherry, and it's really nice to write a song for these special people and then hear how it inspires them to play. So whenever we play this song, Lonely Woman, it really inspires us. And Old and New Dreams plays it a lot. And it's nice, one time I was on a show in L.A. and the person who was spinning the records and talking to me wanted to play both of them back to back. So we played Lonely Woman as it was recorded in 1957 by Ornette's quartet, and then we played it by Old and New Dreams when we recorded it in 1979. And it was really an interesting listening experience.
Let's hear the first recording of it. And again, with Ornette Coleman on alto, Don Cherry on trumpet, Charlie Hayden on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums.
Thank you.
That was Lonely Woman from the Ornette Coleman The Shape of Jazz to Come album with my guest Charlie Hayden on bass. The first Liberation Music Orchestra album that you recorded was in 1969, and in it you combined your music with revolutionary politics. There's a suite of songs from the Spanish Civil War and your composition song for Che Guevara. How do you think music and politics best intersects when you're dealing with music without lyrics, you know, where you can't really tell people what the message is except through the title of a song?
You have to say what you can say in words on the album and in speaking to people if you play it live. It's a normal thing to play music. A lot of people, after they play, they don't even realize the political commitment behind what they're doing. Any person who's doing anything in the arts, I think, has a responsibility to communicate human values, good values, creative values to as many people as they can, and to turn around the value system that's perpetuated in the society by the mass media, by the system, by the conglomerate corporate structure. We are conditioned into a value system of sexist, racist, profit-oriented, materialistic values, and people are dictated to what they should like, what they should wear, the music they should listen to, etc. And then they're sold these things that they're told what to like. And it's about making money. And it's up to the people who are involved in creative arts to turn this value system around. And that responsibility is in itself a political commitment when you really stop and think about the reality of that. As far as playing political music, when I heard the music from the Spanish Civil War, I loved it. When I hear Paul Robeson sing, I love him. When I hear Woody Guthrie sing, I love him. They sing music that comes from people's being oppressed and striving to regain their freedom. Usually music that comes from that kind of situation is really very moving music, because it's about people trying to get their lives back and their freedom. So I always am on the lookout for music that is good for improvisation, that inspires improvisation, that comes from revolutionary conflicts. And I do a lot of research on that. And it's part of my commitment in life to music and to life. And so I try as much as I can to do this. And it's a lot of fun.
Have you had the chance to play this music in the country that it's inspired from, to play any of your liberation music pieces in Spain or in Latin America?
We just played on the tour in Barcelona.
What kind of reaction do you get? Because I think a lot of people in other countries love American jazz so much.
Yes.
Well,
that's exactly what happened. We had a few chuckles and giggles in the audience when we played some of the old Spanish Civil War songs, because to them, and then we happened to play one of the songs that they hear every day, you know. I mean, they didn't want to hear that. They, hey, man, we hear this every day. I thought it would be great to do that, you know. I thought it would spark, you know, people raising their fists in the air, but it was kind of an everyday occurrence to them. One exciting point at that concert was I wrote a song for Dolores Ibarruri, who was one of the heads of the Communist Party during the Spanish Civil War. And she was a very charismatic woman during that period and very brilliant speaker. And she aroused fervor in people when she would speak. And she was the person who coined the phrase, "They shall not pass." And it's better to... what was the phrase she had? Oh, it's really an important... it's better to live on your feet than die on your knees. And I wrote this piece called La Pasionaria, which was her name during that period of time. And she's in her 80s now. She's still living in Barcelona. and I was hoping that she would be at the concert, but she wasn't. Anyway, I dedicated the song to her, and some people afterwards came back and thanked me from the Communist Party, and they really enjoyed that. And it's nice. I wanted to play in Portugal because we had that one piece that I told you about earlier that sparked the revolution. It was a signal to start the revolution there in 1974. But we couldn't play in Portugal. They couldn't set it up in time. You know, I had the great experience of playing for the Communist Festival in 1978. This was after they wouldn't allow me in the country during the when Caetano was in power there after Salazar. I had been arrested on a tour that we did in 1971 when Caetano was there, and it was a fascist government. And I told Ornette, we were playing with the Newport Jazz Festival tour of Europe, which included Duke Ellington's band and Miles Davis and a lot of people, Giants of Jazz, which included Art Blakey and Monk and Sonny Stitt and Al McKibben and Kay Winding and Dizzy Gillespie. And it was really a very exciting tour, but the last place that we were playing out of 14 countries was in Portugal, and I went to Ornette as soon as I saw it on the itinerary, and I said, I'm not playing. And he said, well, we've signed the contract, we should play, you know. You'll get me in trouble if we don't play. So I decided to play, but what I did was we played Song for Che on the concert, and before we played it, I dedicated it to the black liberation movements in Mozambique and Angola and Guinea-Bissau. And it was in a hockey stadium in Cascais outside of Lisbon, and there were 20,000 people there, most of whom were young students and were ready to hear something like that, and they started chanting, and all hell broke loose as soon as I made the dedication, and police were running around with machine guns and trying to get order, and there was cheering. You couldn't even hear the song. There was so much cheering. We were playing for an audience also that were in sympathy with Caetano. There were people there in $10 seats who were in sympathy with what was happening with the fascist regime. And those are the people I didn't want to play for, and I wanted them to know why. I wouldn't have been able to have lived with myself if I'd played and not done anything. So the thing that happened was what I had feared would happen was that I was arrested afterwards, and at the airport they took me into custody and took me to the political headquarters of the PIDE and interrogated me through the night, and I was very frightened and very scared, and I guess that's the most frightened I've ever been, because when you see the reality of something like that, it's like going to the film Missing. It's really happening, you know.
What would they interrogate you about? What they want to know?
Well, I mean, what they really wanted to do was to beat me up and to make me see that I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a foreigner in their land, invading their privacy and their political ideology, and I have no right to do that. They were very upset. You know, they knew that I was an American jazz musician and I had an American passport. It's one of the first things I said, you know, when they arrested me. I said, listen, I have an American passport. Call my embassy. And the guy looked at me, one of the plainclothesmen, and he said, this is a Sunday and the American embassy is closed. And smiling, you know, knowing that I couldn't reach anyone. Ornette, as it turned out, after they took me away, remained at the airport and tried to reach the American ambassador, who wouldn't do anything. He said that the American government had very many economic and political dealings with Portugal, that the main NATO base was there, that it was very embarrassing to the government what I had said, and that I was on my own. Later, he persuaded them to send the cultural attaché to the prison to retrieve me, and I was very happy. My wife had just given birth to triplets back in New York, and it was a very traumatic birth, and I was going to cancel a European tour before I even left New York, and she persuaded me to go. And then after I was arrested, I thought maybe I'd never see my kids. You know, I was really actually crying, you know, and I didn't know whether I would even live or not. But now looking back on it, even though it was very scary and very frightening, I know I would do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that I did it. And especially after they invited me back, when they elected a new government there, and they invited me to come and play at the festival of the communist newspaper, Avante. And I went and played with some French musicians that I had never played with before in front of 40,000 people that were there to see all kinds of cultural exhibits. And I mean, they had exhibits from all over the world, the Third World especially, from political photographs, women's movements in different countries, to political organizations and publications and culture and art and music. And when I started to play, when I came out on the stage, people started chanting my name, 40,000 people, Charlie, Charlie. And it was really unbelievable feeling to hear that, you know.
I'd like to play your 1969 recording of Song for Che from your first Liberation Music Orchestra record.
Okay.
Can you just say a little bit about the writing of this piece?
I was a great admirer of Dr. Ernesto Che Guevara when he was helping Fidel Castro with the revolution in Cuba. And then when he went to Bolivia to try to do something about the oppression in that country. And when I had read that he was murdered by the CIA in the Bolivian mountains, it was very sad to me. And I wanted to do something in tribute to him, because I thought it was very important for people to know about what he really stood for. He has a diary that was since published, you know, a few years after his murder. And people who read that learned about him in that way. But I really love Cuban music. I love hearing Carlos Puebla sing, and a lot of the Cuban folk singers and musicians from Cuba. And I've always dreamed of going there. I was invited to go there several times, and I was never able to do it because of the State Department. But someday I'm going to get there. And so I wrote this song for him called Song for Che.
Let's hear it. And this is, as it sounded, with the Liberation Music Orchestra, as recorded in 1969. It's written by my guest bass player, Charlie Hayden.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bass player Charlie Hayden and his composition Song for Che, as recorded in the 1969 album of the Liberation Music Orchestra. You've never done anything remotely like, quote, selling out. If you decided to, like, go commercial at some point and, like, make it big in session music or whatever, what would you play? Like, if you were really going for the big bucks, what could you envision yourself doing anything like that? It's so different than what you've done.
I can't imagine that happening. Hopefully, a person involved in a minority art form is always wanting to or needing to make a living as a side effect from what they're doing, not to have to think about making a living. I've been very fortunate in the past few years. I've been able to do that. Knock on wood, I hope it still keeps continuing. But at one time in my career, I told the students at the workshop today at the Philadelphia School for the Performing Arts this story. My wife, Ellen, we had just gotten married. She was pregnant with our first child, and we were both scuffling financially. I was working with a little bit with Ornette. I was working with Keith Jarrett. And there wasn't enough money coming in to really pay the rent, and we were living in a four-flight walk-up tenement with cockroaches, you know, the typical New York musician beginnings. And I felt guilty that I wasn't making a living, and so I bought a Fender bass, and I joined Radio Registry, and I started doing television jingles and commercial music recording that was really awful, that I really didn't believe in, but I was doing it. My wife, Ellen, used to come home from her job. She was working as a caseworker for the Department of Welfare in New York City. She had to go out into the field to Bedford-Stuyvesant, to Harlem, to Brownsville, and she would come home so depressed because of the futility of her job. She wasn't able to help people the way she really wanted to. She would come home in tears. And I started coming home depressed, you know. And she said, well, we both know why I'm depressed. Why are you depressed? And I said, I feel like I'm aiding and abetting the enemy. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I feel like I'm contributing to the people who are destroying creative values and who are perpetuating shallow values. And that I'm a part of it. And it's awful to feel like that. I used to get so feeling so bad at a studio that I would just have to leave the studio on the break and go off by myself, you know. I guess maybe I'm too sensitive in that respect. I know a lot of musicians who are in the studios, and they're great people, and I really love them, you know. And that's what they want to do, but it isn't what I want to do. I have a very clear picture of what I want to do and what I feel is important as far as my contribution or my appreciation and respect for this life that we're living, and to try and make it better. And I can't feel that I'm making it better playing commercial music. And I never could, and I never will. That's just the way I am inside. I don't know what made me that way, whether it was genes or environment or... I don't know. It's just something that I know very deeply and feel very deeply, and... I have to do it. So I don't think I could ever envision that happening where I would, you know, after I said that to Ellen, she said, well, why don't you stop? So I sold my electric bass right away, and I dropped Radio Registry, and I never did it again. I'm living in Los Angeles now, which is really centered around the motion picture industry and the recording studios, and a lot of my friends are in the studios, and they do that every day from 9 to 9, you know. They make lots of money. They have Mercedes Benzes, and they live in Beverly Hills or wherever it is they have their houses. And they develop a way of living that's like a lifestyle instead of living a lifestyle instead of living life, and which is okay if that's what they want. I mean, that's great, but it's not good for me. So hopefully I sometime can get some film work of music that I feel is important to do, that I feel is done in an honest way. But until that happens, when I come back to L.A. from being on a tour with whoever I'm with, I have started teaching at a place in Valencia right above L.A. called California Institute of the Arts, and short Cal Arts is what it's called, California Institute of the Arts, and they've never had jazz there before. It's always classical, contemporary classical music. A lot of great composers are in residence there, and so I just started teaching improvisation there, and next year they're going to make a jazz major. I'm teaching there just only one day a week, which is all I can really do now. But it gives me a sense of contribution, of doing something that I feel is really important. I'm sharing my experiences and my playing with young people who are really interested in doing that.
Well, for those of us who listen to jazz, I'm sure I speak on behalf of many people when I say that we're really glad that you've played the music that's important to you. I've certainly enjoyed it, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.